Violinist Joshua Bell does have Scottish roots. He says maybe that's why he has an affinity for the Scottish fantasy by Max Bruch. Either way, he came to it late in life and finally recorded it on his newest recording, which also features Max Bruch's violin concerto. You'll find out more about how he's interpreting it as a conductor as well as a soloist in this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Well, welcome back to the States. Based on your Twitter posts, it looks like you had a great time on your Asia tour.
Yeah, back from Asia for 3 days and heading back to Asia tomorrow. So, yeah, just...
Yeah, I was trying to figure that one out. Who is your tour manager?
Well, I came back to see my kids. And, you know, I could have been getting massages in Bangkok for a few days and recuperating, but no, I'd much rather come back and see my kids.
Wow. How old are they now?
10 and 8, twins, 8-year-old. So, yeah, no, it's a no-brainer.
Well, yeah, so you're going to be heading to Malaysia where you'll perform the Bruch Violin Concerto with the Malaysian Philharmonic Orchestra and Mark Wigglesworth conducting. Now, this is a work that you've been performing for, what, about 30 years?
Yeah, more than that. Yeah, probably about 35 years or more. I actually recorded it once before, and that was already 32 years ago. Yeah, it's a piece I know very, very well, and I love it. I still love the piece. It's really a masterpiece.
So what is it about this work that still inspires you?
Well, it's like any good piece of music, you know, you play it over the years and you grow with it and you're from one day to the next. Now, as I'm directing it as well and playing it, sort of breathes new life into the work for me, because I have this new role of, you know, play conducting, which has made it a lot more fun and interesting for me. Yeah, I felt finally after 30 years, after the first recording, I felt, you know what, I need to do this again. And so I found an opportunity while I was recording the Scottish Fantasy for the first time. I thought it would be a good coupling anyway, so I'm glad I get this chance.
Now, what's especially fun, I think, is the fact that you first recorded this when you were 18 with Sir Neville Mariner in the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. And now, as you said, now you're switching positions. You are the conductor as well as the soloist. Tell me how that's giving you a new perspective.
Well, it's, you know, after so many years of playing the piece with so many different conductors, I mean, hundreds, really, with this piece, you know, you learn a little something from everyone. You learn things that you like, you learn, you know, what not to do. And also just, you, there's so many little details and the things that make the piece work. And you learn how to tell the story in different ways over the years. And now, as when I'm conducting it as well, and I don't have to play the diplomatic game with the conductor there and try to choose my battles, I can really work on all the little details with the orchestra that I've always wanted. My whole wish list. And it's just wonderful to be able to work in detail and work that way. Like, it's like chamber music. And this orchestra, I think we have a really great relationship, and I love playing with them. They play like, you know, glorified string quartet when you play with them. They really play in a way that's really different from playing with a huge orchestra with a conductor. It's just a different experience. And so the Bruch, I think it benefits from this sort of dynamic.
Now, you just mentioned a wish list of things that you've always wanted to emphasize in this work. Can you give me a couple of examples and where we might hear those?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of it has to do with, you know, dynamics, pacing. I mean, there's so many, you know, examples. For instance, the opening of the third movement of the violin concerto, you know, there's a way of building the, just from the beginning, the viola entrances to where the solo violin comes in. There are so many little details, crescendos and subito pianos. Some things are often ignored by conductors. Sometimes they don't strive for the dynamic that I want. You know, but there's a way to build that before I come in so that it just really sets up the perfect entrance. And often I have to find a way to get the conductor to do it the way I want, either by leaning or subtly using body language while the conductor's... I've been accused of conducting alongside the conductor, which is not a good thing, and I don't recommend it. But in this case, I being able to do it myself is just is really wonderful.
So how are you able to communicate that with the members of the Academy of St. Martin in the field so that they understand what it is you're going for?
Well, really, in a rehearsal, I mean, I love the rehearsal process. So a lot of it is done in rehearsal. Some of it is verbal, just explaining, you know, what I want, how I want the story of this piece to be told. I try not to pontificate, and a lot of it is shown just from... With this orchestra, our communication is very good. We've worked together so much that I can sometimes say nothing and just show by body gestures in the very first rehearsal, I can correct things in the way I want without even saying a word. So some of it is done, you know, by talking. Some of it is after so many years of working together, you know, I just raise my eyebrow or bend my knees a little bit or have a certain facial expression which they know, oh, okay, play softer or play a different color here, and they just know me very well in that way. So it's really fun to have that kind of communication, because even in concert, you know, I like to feel room to do improvise, so to speak, not literally with the notes, but with the way you tell the story. And I feel with this orchestra that I really can do that, be spontaneous, and they will react. And that's and the other way around too. They feel that they can do new things. You know, the solo clarinet or oboe or even the whole section, they changes from performance to performance, and I have to react to them. So it's I love that dynamic.
I was just thinking there are some conductors who are really good at providing like some sort of an image as they're trying to get the ensemble to create a certain sound, like imagine a feather floating through the air or something. Do you ever find yourself doing something like that? I actually remember one time, and I can't remember the piece right off the bat, but it was a piece that had a fair amount of ornamentation, and you described it as having to be careful about that because it's almost like wearing too much jewelry then, and that always stuck in my mind. I thought that was a really good way to describe it.
Oh, really? yeah, I mean, one could, you know, with ornamentation or with portamento or slides or even vibrato, which is something that can be overused, you know, the use of vibrato. I mean, all of those things are like, you could call them jewelry. You could use the analogy of a chef. You know, you could call them spices. You know, you don't want to overspice something, but you don't want something bland either. So there are a lot of analogies, you know, to everyday life that you can use in music to find the right balance. And that's really what we do as interpreters. We're just trying to figure out the way to tell the story in the way that's spicy enough, but not pretentious and not over the top, but just the right way. And everybody has a different idea of what that is. And that's why we have room for lots of recordings and performances. And we keep going back to the concert hall to see how this particular artist or orchestra approaches this piece. That's the fun of it.
So how would you describe your interpretation of this Brook Violin Concerto on this new recording? Was there anything new, perhaps, that you discovered that you wanted to bring to the forefront?
Well, a lot of it is in the details, and it's hard to say overall. But basically what I strive for is you know, bringing out the contrast, bringing out the dissonances and the beauties, and bringing out some things, you know, following the dynamics that the composer wrote, that so many of us, including myself, ignored over the years, didn't pay close enough attention. Sometimes it's right in front of you. You know, the composer tells you what to do. It's like, oh my God, that makes a lot of sense. But most of it is reading between the lines and you know, finding the right character, the right atmosphere for the central movement of the concerto, which is really the jewel, the slow movement of the Bruch's G minor concerto is just one of the greatest things written for the violin. Last movement having the right Hungarian, almost gypsy flair. The way I approach is, yeah, certainly different from what I did 30 years ago, and might be different 30 years from now, God willing.
I did want to bring attention to that beautiful adagio because based on how you perform that tender piece, it sounds to me like this is one of the things that you truly do love about this work.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think in order to play any piece, you have to be sort of in love with it. You have to love it. You can't love it half-heartedly and perform it, at least in a convincing way. It's like telling a joke. You have to find it funny to tell a joke. If you don't think it's very funny, you're not going to make anyone laugh. So yes, I only play the pieces that I love, and certainly this concerto. I have a particular affinity for, I think, the slow movement really is because of the fact that I mean, there are many violin concertos, many great ones, but the slow movement of the Bruch is as good as anything written for the violin, I think, in the Romantic era, and I think you can put it right up against those composers that we may be more familiar with, you know, like Brahms and Tchaikovsky. This one stands right up there with the greatest, and I find it very, very special.
If you are telling a story as you perform this work, what is that story for you?
Well, it's, you know, I hesitate to, it's not always so concrete. I mean, that's the beauty of classical music and music maybe in general, that it's abstract. So the story is, you as a listener, you kind of make your own story and it conjures up images. That's what's so great about music. It does, and that's why you can keep also hearing it over and over again. Unlike a film that tells you exactly what the story is, you don't really want to watch it unless it's so great, like The Godfather. You know, you just don't want to see a film over and over again. But a great piece of music, it actually gets better each time you hear it. It conjures up new things, and even the anticipation, knowing where it's going, actually improves it. The element of surprise doesn't exist in the same way as it does in a film, where it ruins it if you know how it goes. In a music, it actually, the anticipation, knowing where it's going, even makes it more exciting.
This is your first recording of Bruch's Scottish Fantasy. Why was now the right time to record this piece?
Well, I actually came to the Scottish Fantasy later in life as far as performing it myself. I grew up listening to it, always loved it, and never found a time to learn it and play it. I got so busy. I didn't study with my teacher, Gingold, during those sort of formative years because I was doing so many other things and somehow didn't get around to it. And then later in life, already in my 30s, I decided, okay, I got to play this piece. I've always loved it. And then I started performing it, and I just love this piece. I never get tired of it, and it's just such a wonderful vehicle for the violin. It shows everything about the violin. It's a beautiful orchestration. So yeah, so in a way it's fairly new for me, although I grew up listening to the Heifetz recording as a kid and felt, even when I started to learn it myself, I felt I knew every note inside out before I even started learning it.
And you have Scottish roots too, correct?
That is true. I don't know if that gives me any sort of special advantage, but my father's side does come from Scottish roots, and I don't know if that's the reason why I love this piece, or that the Mendelssohn Scottish Symphony is my favorite of the Mendelssohn. but it definitely strikes a chord with me. And all the tunes are so, the soulful tunes of the Scottish Fantasy just really, they give me goosebumps when I listen to it, and even when I play it. I mean, maybe especially when I play it. I wouldn't, maybe not goosebumps because you're letting out your emotion through the music, but it definitely touches someplace very deep for me, this piece. Never do I think that this piece in any way is somehow over the top or shallow, which for some reason some people like to say about Bruch in general, because it's popular, they think, oh, well, it's not as deep a piece as the Brahms or the Beethoven. And I think that's sort of hogwash. I think it's incredibly deep and meaningful music.
Well, he wrote such beautiful melodies that just kind of stick in your mind and take you places, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in the Scottish Fantasy, for instance, the opening, funereal opening from the winds and brass. Crazy key of E flat minor. It's a very dark, and the violin enters and with this sustained note that just kind of emerges out of the fog. I can't think of a more magical opening of any piece for the violin.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. Be sure to check out other episodes of New Classical Tracks wherever you get your favorite podcasts. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher.